And yeah, we are. We were thinking of the idea of turning up on the tractor, but then today's weather has just made it a positive decision.
And tell us about your fiancée, Jim, briefly, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I've known her for 5 years. She's in the next village along from me. And she's the one I'm going to spend the rest of my life with.
Okay. Have a brilliant time, Jim. Congratulations. Glad you made it. It's David Cameron in the Commons.
And condemnation at this brutal and savage terrorist attack that has been unfolding in Algeria. Our thoughts and prayers this morning are with those still caught up in this incident, with their families who are waiting anxiously for news, and with those who've already lost loved ones. Mr. Speaker, I have this morning chaired another meeting of the COBRA Emergency Committee and just come from speaking again to the Algerian Prime Minister. So let me take the House through what we believe has happened, the steps we are taking now, and what this means for our security and the fight against terrorism around the world. In the early hours of Wednesday morning, terrorists attacked a gas installation run by BP, the Norwegian company Statoil, and the Algerian company Sonatrach in Aminas in southeastern Algeria near the Libyan border. The terrorist group is believed to have been operating under Mokhtar Belamokhtar, a criminal terrorist and smuggler who's been operating in Mali and in the region for a number of years and who has been affiliated with Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. Mr. Speaker, in Aminas is some 18 hours by road from the capital, Algiers. It is in the middle of the Sahara Desert and one of the most remote places in the world. As a result, it takes time to get a complete picture and the full details are still emerging. But according to the information we have from the Algerian authorities, the terrorists first attacked two buses en route to the Aminas airfield before attacking the residential compound and the gas facility at the installation. It appears to have been a large, well-coordinated and heavily armed assault, and it is probable that it had been pre-planned. Two of those travelling in the convoy to the airfield were very sadly killed, including one British national, and his family were informed on Wednesday. A number of other workers were taken hostage by the terrorists in separate locations, both at the residential compound and at the gas facility. The precise numbers involved remain unclear at this stage, but the hostages included British nationals, along with the nationals of at least seven other countries, and of course many Algerians. As soon as we heard of the attack, we initiated the government's crisis management procedures in both London and Algeria. Our most immediate priority was to establish the identity and whereabouts of British nationals, to contact their families, and to do everything possible to secure their safe return. I chaired a meeting of the government's emergency committee, COBRA. I spoke to the Algerian Prime Minister on Wednesday afternoon, and then again on three further occasions. From the outset, I've been clear about our implacable opposition to terrorism and said that we will stand with the Algerians in their fight against these terrorist forces. But I also emphasise the paramount importance of securing the safety of the hostages. I offered UK technical and intelligence support, including from experts in hostage negotiation and rescue, to help find a successful resolution. And I urged that we and other countries affected should be consulted before any action was taken. I also spoke to the leaders of other countries which had hostages taken, including Japanese Prime Minister Abe, Norwegian Prime Minister Stoltenberg, President Hollande and President Obama. And I coordinated further offers of support for the Algerians in dealing with the situation. Mr. Speaker, during the course of Thursday morning, the Algerian forces mounted an operation. Mr. Speaker, we were not informed of this in advance. I was told by the Algerian Prime Minister while it was taking place. He said that the terrorists had tried to flee, that they judged there to be an immediate threat to the lives of the hostages, and had felt obliged to respond. When I spoke to the Algerian Prime Minister later last night, he told me that this first operation was complete, but this is a large and complex site, and they are still pursuing terrorists and possibly some of the hostages in other areas of the site. The Algerian Prime Minister has just told me this morning they are now looking at all possible routes to resolve this crisis. Mr. Speaker, last night, the number of British citizens at risk was less than 30. Thankfully, we now know that number has been quite significantly reduced. And I'm sure the House will understand why, during an ongoing operation, I cannot say more on this at this stage. Mr. Speaker, our priority remains the safety of British nationals involved, the repatriation of those killed, and the evacuation of the wounded and freed hostages. A rapid deployment consular team is en route to Algiers, together with other specialists, and the Algerian Prime Minister has agreed my request to grant access to our consular staff to fly south as soon as possible to support those involved. I've also spoken with Bob Dudley at BP, both last night and again this morning. We are liaising closely on BP's evacuation plans and have put additional civilian aircraft on standby to assist them with their well-thought-through evacuation plans if needed. Mr. Speaker, we need to be absolutely clear whose fault this is. It is the terrorists who are responsible for this attack, for the loss of life. The action of these extremists can never be justified. We'll be resolute in our determination to fight terrorism and to stand with the Algerian government, who have paid a heavy price over many years fighting against a savage terrorist campaign. This is a continuing situation, and we'll do our best to keep Parliament and the public updated. We hope this will reach a conclusion shortly. There will then, of course, be a moment to learn the necessary lessons. And I commend this statement to the House.
Yes. Ed Miliband.
Oh, well, let's see what the Labour leader has to say.
Mr. Speaker, can I start by thanking the Prime Minister for his statement? And let me say to him on behalf of the opposition that the government has our full support as it responds to these appalling and tragic events. And I want to thank him for keeping me informed over the course of the last 24 hours or so. Can I start by echoing his words in offering our deepest concern and sympathy to the families and loved ones affected by this shocking act of terror? The thoughts of the House and the country will be with the family of the British citizen that has died and all those families enduring the uncertainty of waiting for news of their loved ones. Mr. Speaker, alongside Algerians and other foreign nationals, those involved are British citizens seeking to earn an honest living far from home and their families. It is appalling that innocent, decent people have been targeted in this way. There is no, nor can there ever be, any justification for the taking of hostages. And those who planned and are responsible for this attack must be in no doubt that Britain, along with the international community, stands united in condemnation. It is the hostage takers, as the Prime Minister said, who bear the responsibility for these events, and we must do everything in our power to bring them to justice. Mr. Speaker, I appreciate that the operation on the ground is ongoing, so the Prime Minister is obviously restricted in the information he can reveal. Bearing this in mind, I'd like to ask him some questions. First, the families of those affected will need support and care at this difficult time. So can he assure the House that all necessary support will be provided, either directly here or through our consular services in the region, to the families of those affected? Second, there are a number of other such foreign-owned installations of this kind in Algeria and the wider region. Can the Prime Minister provide some information to the House about how the government is working with British companies to review the security situation at these facilities? Third, given that this incident happened in an isolated part of southern Algeria, what is the government's advice for UK nationals working, living or travelling in Algeria or the wider region? Fourth, at this early stage, what information is the Prime Minister able to share about the motives of the terrorist cell responsible for this attack? And more broadly, can he set out what is the government's assessment of the level of threat posed by groups connected to Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb operating in the region? And had there been any indication of an increased threat from these groups? Fifth, does he agree with me that this attack, alongside the events in Mali, are the latest indication of a still growing security threat in North Africa and the wider region? And does he recognise that this demands intensified international collaboration, intelligence sharing, and diplomatic activity focused on this part of the world? Mr. Speaker, for now, all efforts must be centred on resolving this ongoing crisis and ensuring the safety of British citizens. For the families concerned, this is a dark and difficult time. The whole House stands united in support of them, and the thoughts of the whole country are with them.
Prime Minister.
Well, first of all, can I thank the Right Honourable Gentleman for his support and for his words. He's absolutely right. There is no justification for this hostage-taking, and we will continue to do everything we can to hunt the people down who are responsible for this and for other such terrorist outrages. Taking his questions in turn, first of all, in terms of support for the families, It is absolutely vital they get all the support possible. Police liaison officers are attached to each of the families and can keep them updated with any additional and new information. BP are obviously doing everything they can to support as well. BP have made a statement this morning, which is important because it sets out what they've done to repatriate BP staff from Algeria, and three flights left Algeria yesterday, carrying a total of 11 BP employees. We are providing a backup service to make sure that if there are any gaps in what BP are able to do, we can fill those gaps. His second question about the security of other installations is absolutely vital. We're urgently coordinating with British and Western oil companies in the region about their security in the light of this incident. All installations in Algeria are on a state of high alert, and additional security measures will be put in place where necessary. We've also taken precautions to ensure the security of diplomatic posts in the region and given them advice. He mentions travel advice. This is an important issue. We continue to advise against all but essential travel advice to Algeria. We also advise against all but essential travel to areas within 450 kilometres of the Mali and Niger borders and within 100 kilometres of the Mauritanian border. And the travel advice has been updated to read specifically, a serious terrorist attack has taken place near the town of In Aminas near the Algerian border with Libya. The Algerian security forces have subsequently conducted operations in the area. It remains a very dangerous, uncertain and fluid situation. In terms of the motives and the precise identity of the terrorists, it is always difficult to determine that at this early stage. But what we know is the terrorist threat in the Sahel comes from Al-Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb, AQM. They aspire to establish Islamic law across the Sahel and northern Africa, and they also aspire to attack Western interests in the region and, frankly, wherever they can. He asks quite rightly about the growth of the threat from this part of the world. It is growing. It is a focus, quite rightly, for us and for other countries. The truth is, just as we have reduced the scale of the Al-Qaeda threat in other parts of the world, including in Pakistan and Afghanistan, so the threat has grown in other parts of the world, and we need to be equally concerned about that and equally focused on that. So I hope that answers his questions. I think there is a great need, not just for Britain, but for other countries, to give a real priority to understanding better and working better with the countries in this region. This government has held a National Security Council meeting quite recently on this area. I appointed the Right Honourable Member for Edisbury to be a special envoy to this region, which obviously is a region with great French influence and contacts to France, but where we believe it's very important in our own national interest to thicken and improve our contacts with these countries, and that is what we must do as part of the lessons learned from this exercise. I'm grateful for his questions and the way he puts them. It's difficult to answer further questions on, particularly on numbers, but I will try and keep the House and the country updated.
We'll leave the Commons. This is Five Live. Good morning. Let's talk to our Chief Political Correspondent, John Pienaar. What would you pick out of that, John?
Well, the Prime Minister was deliberately vague, as we heard, Victoria, on the number of Britons who appeared still to be caught up in this, either as casualties or perhaps as continuing hostages, because the operation continues. Overnight, there were reports that we saw that the military operation was said to have come to an end. Well, it has not come to an end. They are still Algerian authorities' forces engaging the terrorists at this gas installation, at least in a part of the site. And the Prime Minister told us that some hostages may well still be caught up in that. He did say that an earlier estimate of maybe 30 Britons caught up in this was over the mark. It was significantly, he said, that was his word, less than that. But beyond that, he was not giving further detail. He confirmed that the Algerian operation began without any notice to him, or as far as he was aware, anyone else, despite an appeal by the Prime Minister to his Algerian opposite number to be kept in the loop, to be informed before any operation was undertook. And he explained that, the Algerian leader, to David Cameron, on the grounds that movement was taking place and he felt it was necessary to intervene quickly. Also, you'll have seen, Victoria, overnight reporting suggesting that the operation was in some way a botch, that this was not well handled. David Cameron did not fuel that kind of speculation. In fact, he went out of his way to avoid, certainly in this statement at least, recriminations against the Algerians, making the point that those responsible were the terrorists. But that remains in the background. What about this operation? Was it done as well as it should have been carried out? Especially since, and again Cameron told us this, they had offered expertise from this country in hostage taking, in rescue operations, and he'd been involved in coordinating similar offers from other countries and leaders that had similar experience. And he named leaders like Obama and President Hollande in France.
Yes. On that point about when the Algerian military responded, he specifically said, we weren't informed in advance, as you said, John, but that he was told by the Algerian Prime Minister that the terrorists had tried to flee and the Algerian military felt that they had to respond. So realistically, it's unlikely that the Algerian Prime Minister would ever have been able to inform Mr Cameron or any other leader in advance.
On the face of that explanation, certainly. I mean, clearly, we know little of the detail of that conversation more beyond the point that David Cameron took us. But yes, that conversation clearly involved the Algerian leader justifying the fact that he'd not given further notice to the countries involved with nationals on the ground. And as you say, he said to David Cameron, an operation had to be carried out quickly for the sake of, well, just preventing the situation becoming worse. But, you know, the speculation about the quality of this operation, that of course, will, I think, continue.
Thank you. John Pienaar, our chief political correspondent, BP, by the way, which part controls this gas plant, has today said there are a small number of employees, quote, whose current location and situation remain uncertain. 11:15, here's Michelle with all the travel news for you.
Thanks, Victoria. Well, the bad weather causing problems on the roads now, spreading east it is actually. We did have the problems to the west of the UK this morning. Those problems are still there, but also now looking at the M25, the bad weather means between Junction 8 at Reigate and Junction 9 at Leatherhead, the clockwise M25, an overturned vehicle in the snowy conditions there is currently blocking one lane and causing slow traffic. On the anti-clockwise side at Junction 21 for the M1, the accident has now been moved to the hard shoulder. One lane is still closed for recovery and queuing traffic remains on that stretch. The M25 clockwise in Essex between Junction 26 at Waltham Abbey and 27 for the M11. Because of an accident, one lane is closed, which is causing queues. If we go back to Bristol, the M5 northbound, a jackknife lorry in the snowy conditions means two lanes currently closed between Junction 15 for the M4 and Junction 14 at Thornbury. Heading north on the M40 in Warwickshire between Junctions 15 and 16 because of the snow, long delays on that stretch at the moment. Driving conditions just aren't great on many of the motorways, especially the M5, one of the worst places as well, heading from Gloucestershire down to Bristol, Somerset into Devon. In Hampshire, the M27 and the M3, tricky driving conditions there at the moment. Many problems on the A road, especially South Wales, where the advice at the moment is to only do that journey if you really, really have to. So many A road closures in place because of jackknife lorries and various stranded vehicles. The best thing to do if you do have to do a journey is head to bbc.co.uk/travel. Quickly looking at the trains, delays across South Wales, all the valley lines are disrupted. Also delays between Bridgend and Cardiff as well. You will find problems trying to catch a train in Plymouth because of the cold weather. The line's having problems there, which is causing delays. In the southeast, we have revised timetables on Greater Anglia, Southern and South West trains. And also looking at the airports, we're seeing delays and cancellations to flights at Heathrow, London City and Leeds Bradford because of the snow. And the following airports have all flights currently suspended. That's Cardiff, Bristol and Southampton. Michelle Dignan, 5 Live Travel.
5 Live Investigates has been doing this on Sunday nights.
We've heard from one unhappy customer who says that instead of making money, he's ended up £23,000 worse off.
How worried are you about these sorts of schemes?
Very worried indeed.
Did you know about this before our investigation?
We didn't know quite how widespread it was.
Sending bills to motorists for accidents they say they didn't cause.
They sent me a big bill of £3,000.
But now it's got a new home. Sunday mornings. From investigative journalism to consumer issues, 5 Live investigates. Sunday mornings from 11.
Let's bring you more reaction to the Lance Armstrong interview, part one anyway. Paul Kimmage is a former cyclist turned journalist who spent years trying to expose doping within cycling. Stephanie Vardavas worked on the Nike Armstrong account for 12 years, worked specifically with Lance Armstrong for 12 years. And Roger Hammond is one of his former teammates at the Discovery Channel between 2005 and 6. Welcome to the programme, all of you. Paul Kimmage, what did you think of what he had to say, his admission and his apology?
Well, I didn't get up at 2 o'clock to watch it, Victoria. I organised my son to get up and to record it for me. And I got up at 4:30. And when I came down, he'd put a little poster on the TV screen. And the message was, try and watch without breaking the TV. I managed for about a minute. And during that minute, I thought, the first minute, I thought Oprah did terrifically well when she restricted the questions and the answer to yes and no. But after that, it was downhill. And by the end of it, I was extremely frustrated and disappointed.
What made you angry specifically?
Well, there was three occasions when Oprah dropped the ball, and there were three important interventions, follow-up questions she should have made. Because I'm not really interested in anything Lance Armstrong has to say about Lance Armstrong. I'm interested in what Lance Armstrong can do for my sport. Mm-hmm. And what Lance Armstrong can do for my sport is to explain how he got away with this for so long, because this didn't happen in isolation. He didn't do this on his own. He was helped by doctors, by officials, right across the sport. So the examples now that really infuriated me were, quite early on, he's talking about, you know, the testing early on was very deficient, that it evolved later and it was much harder later to get caught. But that earlier on, you weren't going to get caught. You're not going to get caught, were his exact words. Now, what Oprah Winfrey should have said to him at that point was, but Lance, you did get caught. And not only did you get caught, you got caught in your very first Tour de France in 1999 when you tested positive for corticosteroids. She didn't ask that question. Now, bizarrely, later on, when Emma O'Reilly was introduced, who was Armstrong's physio, and mm-hmm. they spoke about that same race and that same tour and that same positive test, and she spoke about the backdated therapeutic prescription that was given that enabled him to escape the doping ban he should have got in that first tour. But there was no effort to link one to the other, and that is absolutely of critical importance to you know, what happened after that, because had he been banned, as he should have been, for that infraction, there would have been no follow-up tour wins, and our sport would be in a much, much better place.
Where else do you think she dropped the ball specifically then?
Well, the other point was when he was generalising the abuse of doping in the sport. Mm. And I think he said everybody but five riders basically would have been doping in the tours. And I'm not sure whether it was him or Oprah labelled these five guys as heroes. But what she should have asked them then was, well, tell us, Lance, tell the world now how you treated the heroes, because the hero I'm thinking of is Christoph Bassaert in that very first tour in 1999, who courageously stood up against Armstrong and against the cheats and was drilled out of the sport, was bullied out of the sport and bullied out of that Tour de France by Armstrong. So that was an opportunity missed by Oprah Winfrey that would have explained how people like Armstrong treat people, myself in the past, but Bassaert in 1999, who stood up and said, we don't want doping in our sport.
We heard earlier from the president of the World Anti-Doping Agency, John Fahey, who said what he wants to see now is Armstrong give evidence under oath and potentially an opportunity for USADA to reduce the penalty imposed upon him if he tells the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. Would you agree with that, Paul?
I've got a great problem with that. I've got a great problem with any reduction of any punishment for Lance. In my opinion, Lance Armstrong should be in jail. Now, I love my sport, and I cannot tell you I love my sport without taking the step that needs to be taken in order to do something about that. And Lance Armstrong can take that step. If he was to come in and tell WADA exactly what he did, how he did it, who enabled him, who helped him, the sport would be in a better place. Of that, there is no doubt. Mm. So I've got to be prepared to accept that, and I do accept it, but with great difficulty, because this man should be behind bars for what he did. Because let's be honest here, he's not the first cheat the sport has ever had. What separated them was the degree, the misery he inflicted on good people who really love the sport and really had the sport's best interest at heart. That's what separates Lance Armstrong from the pack. And that's why he should be, it should be behind bars now for me.
I'll come back to you in a moment, Paul, after we've heard from Stephanie and Roger. Stephanie Vardavis worked on his Nike account for 12 years. And an individual who Nike continued to sponsor despite the allegations surrounding him. How did you view what he had to say to Oprah Winfrey, Stephanie?
Well, I think that Lance is not naturally good at contrition. It's not who he is. And as I watched, I wanted to believe him, and to a large extent, I think I did find what he was saying reasonably credible. For me, and as I think about the larger world, I think part of the problem is that when Oprah showed the various video clips of Lance telling bald-faced lies under oath on various occasions in the past, his affect on those occasions was no different from his affect in speaking to Oprah. And so it's very difficult for a layperson or someone who isn't intimately acquainted with him to have any sense of his believability. And I think that's going to be a huge problem for him.
Roger Hammond, did you believe him when he said sorry?
It's a difficult one. The problem is I'm sitting here listening to this and I just think I'm the most unqualified person to be here, really. You know, like Stephanie just said, you really needed to know Lance personally to believe him. And, you know, I was a teammate of his for 2 years, but I chose not to ride Grand Tours. It's something that I'm quite proud of my career in that I was professional for 14 years and I competed in one Grand Tour. Mm. And there was a reason behind that. And as such, I wasn't part of the Lance Tours. I think people don't understand this. This is why I feel like I have to come out and defend myself in this whole situation, because I'm guilty by association, it seems. But
well, don't defend yourself then. I mean, say tell our listeners how you feel about how he has affected how we view professional cyclists.
Well, I'm actually just sick and tired of this now. You know what I came out and said straight away was, firstly, all of the people implicated in this should get the same ban as Lance. I got in trouble last time I was on BBC News because I didn't come out and attack Lance as hard as people thought I should have done.
You got in trouble from
I,
by
I didn't,
who got? What do you mean?
Just
you got in
on
trouble?
Social media.
Oh,
because,
I see. Yeah.
You know, it felt like people thought I was supporting Lance. It wasn't that I was supporting Lance. I just thought actually the only person that received the correct punishment was Lance. Mm. Now, if beyond that he needs criminal investigation in the US, then that's not up to me to decide. But out of my sport, the only person that got the correct ban out of this whole situation was Lance. So I didn't really feel like I needed to go any further into that. Mm. You know, but the real problem, the real issue, I was listening to Paul, and Paul is quite rightly angered. He's more angry than me because, you know, Lance didn't ride my races. He didn't take my career away from me. He didn't take race wins away from me. I was a classics rider and not riding the Tour de France. So what he's done for me now, though, is removed any dignity that I had from my career, and that makes me super angry. I'm very angry about it, and he deserves every punishment that he gets. Yeah. Reducing it now, I don't believe it at all either. I'm the same as Paul.
Yeah.
But I also believe that the people that were helping him and complicit to it also should have got the same bans. And that's what I said right from the beginning.
Sure. So you would like to see the life ban remain. Paul Kimmage, what would be his motivation for going on Oprah Winfrey first to admit some bits?
I don't understand it. And having watched it last night, I understand it even less. I don't know what the game is here, because what is absolutely blatantly obvious is that he regrets one thing, that he was caught. Mm-hmm. Nothing else. Betsy Andreu could be impoverished now. Her husband could have committed suicide. David Walsh could have lost his job. Paul Kimmage could have lost his job. Lance Armstrong would not give a damn. Would not give a damn had any of that happened. The only thing he regrets is the fact that he came back in 2009 and that started the chain of events that means that he has finally been exposed. So I don't know what the game is here. I have absolutely no sympathy whatsoever for him. In fact, I've actually more contempt. I didn't think it was possible for me to feel more contempt for this man than I did before I sat down to watch that programme. But when I saw the qualified answers, and, you know, Michele Ferrari, the doctor, is a good man. Is a good man, you know. I mean, someone has got to explain that to me, how Michele Ferrari is a good man. So I don't know what game he's playing. I just hope he's not indulged. I hope that people who watch that programme will feel the same way I feel about it, and will feel the contempt that I feel for him and the contempt that he deserves.
I want to play our listeners, because many won't have heard it, what Lance Armstrong said to you at a press conference in 2009 at the Tour of California, to you specifically. You were there, having pursued him for years about his doping allegations, and after you confronted him at this press conference here.